We're here to talk about, actually we toned down the title. David was saying that the title was too expensive. I actually wanted it to be How the WHO is Killing Babies, but actually seemed to be a little bit too inflammatory. I've known David Edison for many years as a physician and as a friend here in the FCC as well. And so when he came back from his most recent peregrinations, I think involving Annecy in France, as well as Italy and China and elsewhere, incensed, filled with righteous indignation, built up over the course of 17 years, I think, about the WHO's meeting on rabies in France recently, and said, I must do something at the FCC. We managed to organize it so that on the last day of his visit in Hong Kong, we've got David talking about it. I think most of you know him, so I won't bother with an introduction. We'll just go straight into David's speech and take it from there. David Anderson.
Thanks very much, Christopher. I first really got, well, I was first interested in rabies at the age of 7. When my brother and I were out with our father in India, basically trying to sort it out, and we at the time of the partition, and we were in a place called Dealali, and he and I were sort of 6 and 7 respectively, and we went to find the balloon man. We knew the balloon man what his circuit was, so I took the high road and he took the low road, and he was bitten by a rabid dog and I wasn't. And it wasn't a pleasant experience, really, watching him have the disgusting nerve tissue vaccine injected. I'm not going to say where he was bitten. It was on the low road. That's basically all I can tell you. And he didn't get rabies, which was fortunate. But in 2001, we went back, family members and myself, we went back to southern India, and I went to the Rabies Institute, the Pasteur Institute in Kannur. And I took some photographs and things and talked to them, and that led me gave me contact with rabies experts in Bangalore and elsewhere. And ultimately, Bruce, my middle son, and I made a medical education film in our Medivision film series entitled "Dog Bites and Rabies Prevention," and we published this number 44 in the series. 44 in Cantonese, of course, is Sei Sap Sei, which means dead, extremely dead, which was entirely appropriate for rabies. And we wanted, this was sponsored by a pharmaceutical company that was making a rabies vaccine and had worked out techniques for giving it intradermally, which would bring the cost down to the same cost as this disgusting nerve tissue vaccine, which my brother had in 1947 and Semple had introduced some 37 years before. So it was really time to phase out mushed up sheep's brain. And so we filmed, and we wanted to show good practice in all aspects of rabies prevention. And it was at that point that I discovered that there was something very, very funny about the Wobbly HO's recommendations, guidelines. I think what I better do first of all is just to show you what a ghastly disease rabies is, because in the course of this, making this film, I left my camcorder in Bangalore for 6 months, and Bruce gave them some sort of instructions about how to film. And obviously, the patients signed a consent form. They gave some form of consent shortly before death. And I'll show you one or two clips, if it comes up, from which just show you. I mean, the old name for rabies was hydrophobia. And basically, I better say a little bit about what the disease is. It's a zoonosis. It's transmitted by a bite. 90% of the bites are from dogs and a man's closest friend. And the dog excretes the virus in the saliva and it becomes extremely aggressive. Furious rabies, and they run around, as do a lot of animals with rabies, just biting people and things. And obviously, what you need... Well, let's just explain the disease. It sits in the wound, okay? And there's a race against time, really. I'm talking about people who haven't been immunized previously. If you've been immunized previously, all you need is a booster dose. And I would recommend anybody going to India to get rabies immunization, because it'll be an absolute nightmare if you get bitten by a dog and you then try to get the appropriate treatment in India. So you're bitten by a dog, and the virus is injected into the wound. What it will do is it'll replicate in the wound, and in the fullness of time, it may get into a peripheral nerve ending. And once it gets into the peripheral nerve ending, it is then transmitted by retrograde axonal flow, which means backwards, up into the nervous system at a centimeter an hour, quite fast. And once it's in your nerves, you are as good as dead. You definitely, it's curtains, because it will replicate in the spinal cord, then in the central nervous system, destroy it in the process, and it's an extremely unpleasant death, as you'll see now. Let's just see if we can bring up. Oh, double click. I think I remember. Maybe we're just going to double click this. May just take a little bit of time to load. Okay, well. Okay, so these are descriptions of
rabies, beginning with the mechanisms behind the classical symptoms of hydrophobia and aerophobia.
So this is a gentleman with hydrophobia and aerophobia.
The mechanism of hydrophobia is still not very clearly understood. It's only seen in human beings. One of the explanations is because of the paralysis of the pharyngeal and tracheal muscles, the water tends to enter into the respiratory tract, which causes severe spasm of the respiratory muscles. And later on, this becomes a conditioned reflex, and the mere sight of water will evoke a terror in the patients.
So at the same time, they become extremely thirsty because they can't...
Yeah, because they are not drinking any water at all because of the fear. So naturally, they will become very thirsty.
This woman shows how aerophobia. Please don't breathe on me. It was a good vaccines were needed. And that, I think, is perhaps a poignant point. It's the sort, when professionals give advice, it should be correct advice. But the problem, that's probably enough rabies for you to see. We've got a few more clips. But it's an extremely unpleasant way to die, and once you've got the symptoms, you're going to die. There's no recovery. And what is more, you know that you're going to die. Even the children, they know that they're dying. And consciousness tends to be retained towards the end. I think we'll just switch that off. So, you're bitten by this putatively rabid dog. What do? You wash it under soap, running water with soap for 10 minutes at least, rubbing into the wound, getting as much of the virus away as possible. You follow that by pouring in Dettol or whiskey or some sort of antiviral agent. This is an RNA virus. And those measures will reduce your chances of getting rabies by 50%. You clearly, we're assuming you're not immunized, you need a course of active immunization. And this was where these were the people who sponsored our film, Chiron, who were making a tissue culture vaccine, given by an intradermal injection, which is highly economical. So their procedure was going to bring the cost down to the same cost as the disgusting mishmash nerve tissue vaccine. But you're going to take 10 days before you start to raise antibodies. And during that 10-day window, you're really sitting on a time bomb, a potential time bomb. You have no control over it, except to take the third measure, which is to inject into the wound rabies immunoglobulin. Now, the only type of rabies immunoglobulin I want to talk about, because it's the only thing relevant in India and Asia, is equine rabies immunoglobulin from horses. Horses are big. You can't patent a horse. You can hyperimmunize it, and you can purify rabies immunoglobulin very effectively. So it is actually purified E-Rig, or equine rabies immunoglobulin, is not only highly effective, it's highly non-allergenic. At most, 1 to 3% of people given E-Rig will develop serum sickness, and it's been estimated that 1 in 50,000 will develop an anaphylactic reaction. So it's highly effective, and it should be inexpensive. Unfortunately, in India, where 20 to 30,000 of the 55,000 deaths in the world occur in India, it could easily be 100,000, by the way, because it's a complete guess, only 2% of dog bite victims are currently receiving equine rabies immunoglobulin. The only reason we could film people getting rabies immunoglobulin, there was no equine rabies immunoglobulin available in Hyderabad, was by buying some human rabies immunoglobulin. We paid about $50 and injecting that. Now, this is, in my opinion, a scandal. That was 6 years ago. And 6 years later, the situation is exactly the same. So my question is, I started to question people. I was interviewing people on this expert committee in the course of making this film, and discovered that, yes, people felt that it was really unfortunate that these people weren't getting E-Rig, and it was very difficult. It's expensive and all that. But it turned out then, I started looking at the guidelines. The first thing that alerted me was they weigh the patient. So the dose that is injected is determined by the weight of the patient. So a 50 kilogram man, or 100 kilogram man, bitten by the same dog as his 20 kilogram son, the calculated dose is five times as much, which is costs five times as much too. And I thought, hang on, it would make more sense to weigh the dog or measure the wound. It does make sense to measure the wound. And the regulations state that you're allowed to dilute it 1 in 3 if they're very big wounds. You dilute it 1 in 3 in saline. And you inject as much as you can into the wound. All of that makes sense. One of the cases on our film was a little boy who was bitten on the second toe of his left foot. Now, it doesn't matter which foot, second toe. Now, you cannot put 5 mils of anything into a second toe of a left foot of a small boy. It would at most have taken 0.5 of a mil before you get a compartment syndrome. But you need to inject it locally because that's where the virus is. So how did it come that WHO has this recommendation that you weigh the patient? Well, that dates back to the 1960s when rabies immunoglobulin was being given parenterally, in other words, into a distal site, and they were trying to achieve a blood level around 0.5 of a unit per mil. And at that time, it did make sense. It does make sense if you're giving it to a distal site, but it was soon realized, it actually should have been realized then, that the only place it was needed was into the wound. It made sense then, however, to weigh the patient. So then, in 1992, they said, right, the wheels of this committee grind exceeding slow, like there was a review in 1992, and the next one was 2004. It's speeding up a bit. The next one's 2010. We have this preliminary meeting to discuss what should be discussed in 2009. So they just said, right, okay, we'll still weigh the patient, but we'll give as much as possible into the wound. And what do we do with the rest? We don't give it to the next patient. In the Hyderabad dog bite clinic, they have 180 new dog bite victims a day. Oh, no, that's much too sensible. We give it into a distal site. So the patient still gets it, into the body, despite the fact that their own evidence from all of these studies shows that giving it elsewhere, remember you're trying to actively immunize this individual as well, obviously if you give too much of the immunoglobulin, you're going to bind the immunogen that you're trying to use to raise the antibodies. So it's actually counterproductive. So I was sort of incensed, but and have been moving very fast in comparison with the movement of this committee. So I wrote a paper, got to reviewing how this had come to be, and it was turned down by the Lancet and turned down by the New England Journal, but it was eventually published, thanks to someone called Henry Wilde in Thailand, in a fairly obscure journal, Asian biomedicine journal, in the middle of 2007. And it was obviously regarded as, well, this chap Anderson, he's a bit of a troublemaker, but maybe he's got a point here. So, the next thing that happens is that I get an invitation in August or September by WHO to go and present something to them, to their discussion, about the use of rabies immunoglobulin. So I went along and I prepared my case pretty well, and I made a PowerPoint presentation, and the arguments were pretty clear cut, that we should change these recommendations so that a sensible dose is given. It doesn't depend upon the weight of the patient. We bear in mind that it has to be affordable, so we don't keep the, we give the minimum effective dose in the most effective way to as many people as possible. And so I went to this meeting, and I actually came up with four draft recommendations. I mean, I really did cause a lot of nuisance. And it was quite clear that the WHO experts have no interest in this at all. And the worrying thing from, this is it's only a foreign correspondence club, but it is a correspondence club. The worrying thing from the press's point of view, I think, should be that things have moved in 6 years. There are now pharmaceutical companies making monoclonal antibodies. Now, you don't have to clone a horse to make it produce antibodies, but monoclonal antibodies, so Sanofi Pasteur are producing monoclonal antibodies to, which are going to be patentable, aren't they? And in 5 years' time, they might give them free for use in India. So what I would suggest is that this is a scandal, because it's like, I mean, I've also been reading a book on D-Day, and I noticed there that the troops were advancing on a number of fronts, but one didn't just leave a big gap. You know, you actually put troops, you may not put enough troops, but you do try to have troops along the whole front. And here we have a situation, you wash the wound, well, that's badly done, so WHO could tell people how to do that better. But then you've got a 10-day gap where you're doing absolutely nothing, and you've got an extremely aggressive virus that will kill you in an extremely unpleasant way if during those 10 days it gets into a peripheral nerve. Now, my recommendation to them, you might say, well, okay, as they said, well, you have to do a double-blind trial. You know, you've got to do a trial. I said, hang on. Nobody's ever done a double-blind trial of common sense, because obviously it doesn't make any sense to do it, does it? So, you know, your own regulations show that this is complete nonsense what you're doing. And we know that the original doses were calculated to give a level of half a unit per mil in the serum, all around the body, okay? Even my recommendation, which is very, very, it's very modest, is to calculate it based on what you give a 25-kilogram child, which happens to be the average bitten person in India, a 10-year-old boy, and you allow that diluted 1 in 3, which you do anyway if there's lots of wounds, that is still going to give you more than 100-fold overkill in the wounds, which is where you want it. And, I mean, you'd think that intelligent people, well, actually quite a lot of the people came up afterwards and said, well, yeah, what you said makes sense, we like it, we think it's good. But the trouble is, when you put a bunch of intelligent people into a World Health Organization committee, you bring in all sorts of other factors. I mean, nobody wants to be labeled a troublemaker except somebody like me, who's never going to be invited back to address this committee again. You work in Bangkok or you work in the Philippines, and every so often the World Health Organization flies you over to Europe. That's quite nice. And anyway, you've got aggressive people. There's one extremely aggressive veterinarian. I wouldn't have liked to be bitten by him. From the CDC, who, I mean, was really, really unpleasant to some of these rather submissive Indian experts there. And, you know, you have a dysfunctional committee. So I want the message to get out that WHO doesn't care. I mean, their next expert committee is meeting 30,000 deaths from now in April. There is no sense of urgency about bringing the number of the percentage up of stuff you can get from horse serum. And the WHO has got the Gates Foundation in it, for goodness sake. The Gates Foundation surely could buy a few horses and stick them full of, immunize them to rabies and purify it. Gates Foundation supporting monoclonal antibodies, and things, fancy things. So I think I made it quite clear. Look, I said, I've nothing to lose. As far as I'm concerned, this is time for a bit of fan shit hitting. And that's what I intend to do. So thank you very much for your attention.
Any questions?
And on that note, if there are any questions, I think the room is probably small enough that you can just stick your hand up. I don't know if we've got a mic runner running around. But I will lead off and ask about actually the NGO activity that is not WHO related. Is there anybody else out there? You mentioned the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. Is there anybody else out there who's even expressed any interest, or is it too early in your trumpeting of this cause?
Well, there is a sort of World Rabies Day, and there's an awareness thing. The problem is that the people running this are also members of the committee. I mean, Debbie Briggs runs this. She's fine. She's a vet. But she is somebody who's extremely conservative about what, how you can change things. I mean, my argument is you don't need a bleeding double-blind controlled trial to prove that something is better than nothing. You could actually use your head and you can do the sums and work out that, 100-fold overkill. Actually, my recommendation would mean that a 10-kilogram child would actually be getting a better dose than they do at the moment. But there's World Rabies Day, but it's all sort of throw your hands up in horror and say, isn't this ghastly? We have to do something. But then, rather than saying, well, why are the world's estimated deaths from rabies exactly the same as they were 6 and 10 years ago? And if there's an obvious, as there is, an obvious weakness in the defense, well, surely that's what you should direct your efforts at. I found in this committee that the chairman, a chap called François Meslin, is he's sort of a chairman. I mean, he basically deals with zoonoses all over, so, Nipah virus and stuff like this. Rabies probably comes fairly low down the list. But anyway, I mean, he convenes these meetings. He thinks like a vet. I mean, he doesn't have any idea about clinical medicine that actually often we're used to doing the best we can. You can't have a clinical trial, but all their data is there. All their data anyway was much of it was from animals. Some human data showing that rabies immunoglobulin. There was a famous case in the 1950s where a rabid Iranian wolf bitten at 29 people. And 17 of the worst cases, or 19 of the worst cases, I think it was, 17, got rabies immunoglobulin injected into the muscle and active immunization, and 12 just got the active immunization. And it was selected and biased in favor of the worst cases were the ones getting the rabies immunoglobulin. And, one of those died as opposed to 3 out of 12 of the others. It's about that sort of level, the human stuff. But you can't do those studies. What they could do is they could come up with something and say, right, at the moment, instead of rabies immunoglobulin costing, if you can get it, 5 to 10 times the cost of the active immunization, let's do something about it. Let's let WHO do something useful. After all, for leprosy, it provides free drugs for every patient with leprosy in the whole globe. courtesy of a pharmaceutical company, they could lean on Sanofi Pasteur and say, okay, we'll support your, you know, you're doing monoclonals, but, you know, how about paying for E-Rig in the meantime? And it could be done if there was a willingness, but they're caught. It's trapped in the illogicality of its own past history. Most of these people, Meslin has been in charge of this committee for 22 years. Well, that's nearly a quarter of a century, you know. And of course he doesn't want to admit he's wrong. So, you know, I've wandered off the point, but that's allowed, isn't it?
No, it's completely, it's encouraged, in fact, encouraged.
Yes.
My question's a bit different. Hello? I was going to ask you, what measures of palliative care, if any, are given to these poor people who have rabies, both in a place like India and more developed countries?
Oh, well, I mean, they get a bit of sedative, and that's it. And oh, no, actually, most of the palliative care consists of sending them home to die, because it's much cheaper to send somebody home when they're alive than when they're dead. No, I mean, palliative care, you know, you wouldn't want to go there. I mean, but basically,
In a U.S. hospital, what do? They give them morphine or something?
Well, I think they do. I mean, they've... Yes, there is one. There's ketamine.
One lone survivor of clinical rabies.
With severe brain damage, I think.
She's got some brain damage. Well, apparently not that severe, but she's the only known case. And they use something called the Wisconsin Protocol, which was deep sedation with a cocktail
yes.
of drugs.
Ketamine
and
things.
That's become kind of the standard of care, so they try that. So it basically involves making the patient unconscious.
But in terms of the world response to rabies, it's a total irrelevance because it's like, you know, a better example would be tetanus, which you can recover from. But I mean, in the third world, in the Philippines, etc., if you get tetanus, there's no way you're going to get the intensive care that you would need to recover from it. And that applies probably 10 or 100-fold more to rabies. But it's 100% preventable disease. And what we're talking about here, I mean, one of the other things about this committee is they are, quite reasonably obsessed with veterinary sort of things, like, you know, how do you stop people in the Amazonas getting bitten by vampire bats, which is the main, and that's important. But I found in this committee that, rabies immunoglobulin was just being discussed as an afterthought. And yet, it's as plain as a pikestaff that if you want to cut down world rabies deaths next year or the year but year after, that's what you have to do. And it's not. And we heard. I mean, there were hours of waffle from people. Some of them were called Mary. One particular one. You know, who's got a bee in her bonnet about Oxford's, you know, 8-site regime. This is for active immunisation, bringing it down to a 4-site regime. Not going to make the slightest bit of difference. It might, there's still the 10-day window you've got to cover. Until, you know, all the dogs are immunised, all the dog licences in India.
Yeah. And elsewhere.
And elsewhere, yes.
It's an issue. Obviously, India has probably the worst problem in Asia, but China has a terrible problem with rabies, and all of the rest of Asia outside of the developed centres have significant rabies. And there is no rabies immune globulin to be had in most places outside Thailand, I think, and here.
I understand, are they manufacturing it now in China?
China has a number of producers of their own rabies immune globulin. Unfortunately, none of it has been kind of looked at outside of China. And, you know, they have lots of problems with their pharmaceutical industry, and they're making human rabies immune globulin, and it's a blood product, so there's a fair amount of concern about the safety of that. And they still have a lot of rabies deaths, even in people who get it. But I guess my question is, you know, we're now seeing, sometimes the way to leverage these things is when it starts to affect the Western world, despite the fact that the numbers in Westerners are very, very small. But there are people being bitten now throughout Asia. Bali has a big problem with
Bali Flores, yeah.
And they have no rabies immune globulin on Bali.
Yeah.
So people are being given incorrect post-exposure treatment with no rig, and or they have to leave if they know enough to leave.
Mm.
And so I just wonder if somehow that situation, which we're now seeing increasingly, I deal with it all the time,
mm.
if that can be kind of leveraged to raise awareness about the fact that there's a terrible worldwide shortage of rabies immune globulin and that there are ways, there may be better ways to approach this.
Yeah, it's sort of difficult without waking up. I mean, I think one does have to insist, which is what I'm trying to do, that the WHO wakes up. Because if, you know, if this is not a responsibility of WHO, I'd like to know what is. And, it, you know, the technology is there. Yes. Paul.
What are your thoughts on the use of immunoglobulin in people who have been pre-immunized? There's been a bit of debate about that, whether it's worthwhile or not. But it would seem to me if the bite's bad and it's and you're sure that it's or fairly sure it's a rabid bite, then it would make sense to further reduce the chances of developing it. And another thing, in some parts of the world, there seems to be quite a high incidence of acquired immunity. Iran, for example. What's the situation in India, do you know?
Acquired immunity
to people who have been bitten by rabid beasts but don't develop the disease. 40% or something was quoted for Iran. I don't know about India. Do you know?
I don't. I mean, I would. I suppose, you know, there's a chance that as the virus replicates in the muscle, it generates an immune response. Probably many of these people would have had a shot of nerve tissue vaccine or something as children. They wouldn't remember about it, and then this would be an anamnestic response. But I mean, I think, you know, I think they're getting on to sort of travel medicine. I wouldn't see any problem with that. I mean, I think equally, if you know the person, if you, it has been immunized by a conventional intramuscular or intradermal regime, and they, then what you need is two boosters on day one and day three. And you could, of course, as you're giving your first booster, take blood and check what the antibody titer is. But I mean, the chances, I don't know that there's been any recorded cases of rabies following a course of active immunization. Even probably the nerve tissue vaccine is not as bad as it's thought. It's just, it causes Guillain-Barré syndrome and other things. So it's probably dotting the I's and crossing the T's, but I'm sure you could send serum off for a titer and get it back within 24 or 48 hours, or it's not going to do any harm. No, you won't get any outcome because the mortality is so low in that situation. But I mean, the figures from quoted by Sudarshan for India, something like of their class 3 dog bite victims, about 7 to 10% are presenting with clinical rabies with the current regime. And my bet is that you could reduce that at least to a half and probably to a quarter by effective rig use. It is, of course, you know, it does require to set up a system, but I found that the arguments people were putting forward were, well, they do things badly in India. They're not going to learn about it. But I've been to the Hyderabad dog bite clinic, where they have 600 patients a day, of which 180 are new dog bite victims. One of the other things that is also nonsense about the recommendations is that In the WHO regulations, which people do follow regulations, you're told that if you're giving equine rig, you need to have a test dose. Now, what that does is it doubles the work per patient, and it's also a very strong disincentive to do nothing, because everybody knows it doesn't predict. Anaphylaxis is the only reaction you'd be concerned about. The figures from Thailand are something like 1 in 50,000. Give me a break. You know, when you've got 1 in 10 or 1 in 20 chance of getting rabies, and it isn't going to predict it, so they should just go ahead, give the rabies immunoglobulin, and ask them to wait for half an hour. But you know, getting something simple like that. I mean, I said four things you've got to do. You know, to make this a practical thing, and WHO has an obligation to make the product available, and you know, it just drew a complete blank. I can guarantee that unless it gets a really big kick up the backside, this committee is going to do nothing. They're quite worried about publicity. That's the only thing. So let's give them some.
Try to do more. Jake has a question here. We've got about 10 minutes left, so we might be able to take one or two more, and then we'll have to wrap it up.
David, read this fan-hitting business and kick up the backside business. The Wobbly Health Organization, as you referred to, it is a bureaucracy, and the most bureaucratic of bureaucracies, an international one, a Geneva-based one, a United Nations-sponsored one, and to do anything needs to satisfy all kinds of procedures and other things of that sort. That is in the nature of that sort of bureaucracy. The only time that you can get superseded is in wartime, if you have a Winston Churchill saying, action this day, and putting a stamp on it. Otherwise, not. Don't you think that your approach may be a bit counterproductive in being quite as fierce as you describe it?
Nothing's going to happen unless, it's worth trying. I mean, you know, what I've seen, I've done a controlled trial. I've tried just being very nice and reasonable for 6 years, pointing it out to people. And that's had no effect, so I think we should do the second arm of the trial.
Will it work with the WHO rather than creating enemies for yourself and stalling the process?
I don't think these guys are that malignant. I don't think they'll go and kill me.
Kill the process.
You see, one of the reasons that I felt it was important for me to come out is that I was the only person attending that meeting who had really got nothing to lose by telling the truth. And, I mean, to give you an example, there's a very nice doctor in Thailand who thinks exactly as I do, who's actually pushed the envelope as far as possible. I mean, he got them to give it, you know, as much as possible into the wound. He's working with an 82-year-old American rabies expert, and agrees with me, but daren't come out in the open to say it. And that, you know, somebody else wrote to me and said, please don't disturb, don't upset the expert committee. Why? Why not? The expert committee needs to be reconvened. If the WHO, if enough fanshit hitting occurs, then WHO is going to say, oh, gosh, there's a thing in the South China Morning Post saying we're killing people with rabies. You know, we're responsible. They are responsible. And when they've corrected their recommendations and it's made no difference to mortality, well, then they can hold their hands up and say, and I'll say, okay, I was wrong. Maybe it was something else. But it's so bleeding obvious. You know, do you have to... Yeah, I mean, what do you think, Sarah?
I wonder if anyone has ever looked at the cost effectiveness of introducing rabies vaccination into the childhood immunization schedule.
That's also discussed, and they didn't like that. The vets didn't like that at all.
Why?
I don't know.
It seems to me, the incidence of the disease is high enough in some of these places that it would...
Of course you're right, and there's Thailand, they've done the studies, and there was a very good paper on the cost effectiveness of childhood immunization program in Thailand. And, you know, the break-even, I mean, it's costly, but, you know, it's cost-effective.
Because RIG is so expensive, if you don't need...
No, but you see, RIG isn't... The only reason RIG is expensive is there's very little of it. The only reason there's very little of it is there's very little used. And the only reason there's very little used is they've made it so expensive. So we've got a total circular argument there. They could make it really cheaply. WHO could inject the funds in, Gates Foundation could inject the funds in to get the production jacked up. We can use Hong Kong racehorses, you know, or whatever. I mean, there's lots of horses there being put out to graze. And the technology for producing the FAB2 fragments is easy, non-reactive, and it's got to be better than nothing. I mean, they said, well, you've got to do the studies first. I say, you change the thing to something that makes sense and is humane and makes the drug available, and you instruct people how to use it, and you do the studies at the same time. You can then measure, but it's totally immoral to do what they're doing, which is to say, well, we have to wait till we get the evidence, and then they're the people who're supposed to be getting the evidence, and they're not even trying.
What was the argument against vaccinating?
Vaccinating who?
Children, like pre-exposure, you know, in India or Thailand or China, making it routine. What was the argument against?
Well, I'm not going to justify other people. I mean, it didn't seem to make sense to me, but, you know, this was very vocal vets. saying, you know, we have
about
to get...
About humans.
Yeah, but I mean, it's the dogs biting the humans, not the humans biting the dogs. So it won't make any difference for 10 years or so, because you've still got, you know, there's programs for immunizing young children. You probably start at toddler age. I mean, you don't do it at birth. And, you know, two or three shots and a booster at puberty. Yes, it'll produce lifelong immunity. But, of course, to work through a population is going to take 5 or 10 years. You've still got a problem but yes, of course. And I mean, it's just that, you know, I'm concentrating on what do we do with somebody who comes through the door in a Hyderabad dog bite clinic? And the answer is you
never go through the door, never even get as far as the hospital, you know.
Yes. And I mean, it's used almost as an excuse because they're, you know, the health service in India is not very good. That doesn't mean you shouldn't try and improve it. And it's only 20%, it's 10 or 20%, even in the Philippines and Thailand, where they're pretty well organized, relatively. It's only 10 or 15, 10 to 20%, still 80 to 90% of people at risk are not getting it.
Right. Which is probably as good a place to end our discussion as any, because we could go on. Last question? Yeah.
Sorry. Hello, David. Nice to see
Hi.
You again. So you're getting on a jet plane tonight and going back to Italy, I presume. I'm quite interested because you're really excited about this, and I can play light on that. But then we can think of 30,000 deaths in the next 6 months, which is quite sobering. So what's your battle plan to try and make a change? And what are you going to do the next 6 months? And
I'd like this message to get back to the Blessed Margaret, who heads WHO and comes from Hong Kong. She should be asking questions because, if necessary, we'll try and interest Panorama. I mean, I think it's just such a blatant hole in the defensive strategy, and I just think that other people should also be involved. I mean, I'm going back to Hong Kong anyway. I'm going back to Italy anyway, but I felt that not having I thought, well, hang on, I don't have to be nice to these people. Everybody in the committee has to be nice to everybody else. I don't. I mean, why personalize it like that? You know, if being nice means not stating the bleeding obvious, I'm not going to do that. But I think that Hong Kong is a good place to start. It's at a fulcrum. China, as Sarah said, China's a major problem. At least 3,000 to 5,000 deaths the year before last, I think, in China. Yeah. Bali, Flores, both epidemics, complete denial by the authorities.
So who's on your team? I mean, you can't fight that alone. So who have you recruited in Hong Kong while you're back in sunny Italy?
Well, I thought I'd recruited the FCC. I was working on Chris, you know.
Yeah.
He's got a good name for this.
It works out very nicely for a lot of different things. I mean, I guess that's the next step.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, with the short notice that we had, we didn't get as many journalists here as we wanted. Yeah. But, you know, the next step is to publicize it and get more attention about it. We'll certainly put something in the Correspondent about that. That's a very small step. But at least it has the community of journalists who are members here paying attention to it. And it just means beating the drum some more. So
there's a parallel situation a little bit with Japanese encephalitis, which also kills a similar number of children, mostly every year in Asia, and Japan, has an excellent live-attenuated vaccine, with which they have brought down their rates of Japanese encephalitis by 90%. And for years, the WHO has been dragging its feet on pre-approval of that vaccination for use elsewhere, which has hugely slowed
So I'm appointing Sarah on my committee. Right.
Honorary chair. We do actually have to wrap it up there, unfortunately. But thank you all very much for attending, and consider that the opening salvo in a war against
thank
rabies.
You.
No? Okay.
Thank you.
We've got a treat for you, sir.
Hmm?
We have a treat for you. Oh my God. Every speaker walks away with a treat. I have no idea what it is, but I think it's a piece of clothing that probably won't fit.
Okay.
The t-shirt.
Thank you. All right, stand everyone.
Photos.
Photo shoot.
Okay, ready? One, two, three.
Right.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. For
I've got to run. It's a pleasure. Absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for coming. And thank you for getting in touch with us. But now, I have a few questions. What's the kind of thing that
That's a platitude. It's a platitude that it's a slogan that they use.
Slogan.
It's okay. Bye. Thank you. Now, I mean, that probably is the slogan thanks for going, Roger. Yeah. See you later.
Thanks.
Well, I don't want to go into that. I mean, yes, of course one needs one. Bye, Eugenia. Thank you. Yes. I had a case somewhere about. Bye. Ciao. Bye, Stuart. Steve.
Have a good flight back.
Thanks.
Good luck with the.
Thank you. Oh, right. Oh, yes. Yes, sure. I've been on the. I was interviewed by. What's his name?
One of our programs.
I Phil.
Oh.
Yeah. I Phil Whelan.
Yeah, sure.
I'll do that tonight. Yeah. You must soon. I don't know when. She maybe once every 2 or 3 years. She's not. She might come on my next trip. Who knows? Because that's the exploration. But. Anyway, thanks for coming. Bye. Right.
This
where should we go?
Alex. He has some questions.
Hi, Alex.
Hello.
Right. What are you doing, Alex? What's your...
He's our intern reporter.
Oh, right.
Sorry, maybe we have
sit down.
To...
Would you have to go somewhere? Can we sit here?
Yeah, it's fine. Can I sit here?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Sorry, you may have to repeat a little bit of your speech because we want to get the message across to our listeners.
Yes. Which program is this?
It's going to be on our news rack, 6 to 7.
Right, good. That's which program is that?
It's on Radio 3.
Radio 3.
Dr. Andrews, what are the problems?
Anderson.
Oh, yeah. Dr. Anderson, what are the problems with the initial vaccine and why are the WHO guidelines problematic?
Well, there are two questions there. To distinguish between a vaccine, which is active immunization, and what I'm talking about, which is passive immunization. So,
The problem, I mean, the active immunization, that's not really what concerns me, because people are now, the pharmaceutical companies have got, or getting rid of this old-fashioned nerve tissue vaccine, which has been around since 1910, and replacing that with modern tissue culture vaccines. The problem is that if you're bitten, let's assume, have you been immunized against rabies yourself?
Yes, I think so.
What, you think so?
I think so.
When?
When I was quite young.
Well, you need to know, you see, because that's not enough to think so if you go to India or somewhere like this. Let's say that you haven't been immunized against rabies, which would be a course of three injections over 2 or 3 weeks, 3 or 4 weeks. Then, if you're bitten by a rabid animal, an animal with rabies, you need to wash the wound out as thoroughly as possible, as quickly as possible. You need the active immunization, but that leaves you with this 10-day window. Because the active immunization, if you've never seen an antibody, if you've never been immunized before, then it's going to take at least 10 days to start raising enough antibodies to block the virus. So that's why it needs to be injected into the wound. Bye, Sarah. And the problem that we've seen, oh sorry, did we?
No, it's okay.
The problem that I've found with the WHO guidelines is that they don't take account, I mean they're calculated that the dose that you're recommended to have is actually much higher than you need. It's calculated on a completely illogical basis, which is your weight, whereas you're injecting it all into the wound. So it really should be injected at a concentration which we could discuss into the wound to a capacity that the wound will take. And they've got themselves very muddled because of the way in which these recommendations have just grown up over the years. It's highly illogical. And nobody, in my opinion, nobody who should care, seems to care. Instead of saying, right, this is a major problem, it's a major weakness in defense, that effectively nobody in India is getting rabies immunoglobulin, which we all agree is essential. Instead of saying, right, this is a weakness in defense which we have to address, to make sure that they get, you know, they should look at it logically. Instead of that, they're turning it, they look at it and say, well, you know, this has been like this for a long time. We have to change things slowly, you know, we've got to have evidence for change. Well, the evidence is there already.
So why do you think the WHO rejected your proposals?
Well, it wasn't the WHO so much as their expert committee. I think, my own opinion, if you want me to personalise it, is that the person who coordinates the committee, who you know, is based in Geneva, is not receptive to change. He's been there too long. I mean, I'm not trying to get rid of him, but his attitudes are clouded by, you know, decisions that were made 10 or 20 years ago when he was also on the committee. And under a different chairmanship, I think we could have had a more reasonable discussion. But as it was, I was just asked to talk, and then the discussion was rushed. And I said, well, you know, we need more evidence before we do anything. So I can't answer for them. I mean, they should answer for themselves. They should be asked.
If your proposals are not accepted, what are your projections on what will happen?
Oh, people just carry on dying of rabies like they're doing at the moment. I mean, they've got to, have got to face the fact that the figures are no different. They may be even worse than they were 6 years ago, because you know if equine rabies immunoglobulin, it's not a particularly complicated or sophisticated or new drug. Pharmaceutical companies aren't going to make any money out of it. The best that you could hope is that people in the pharmaceutical industry who are making money out of rabies vaccines could be lent upon, or, you know, the Gates Foundation could pay for the production and distribution of this essential component. But as it is, as I said, one of the worrying things is that there are other types of antibody, and there's fancy modern techniques producing monoclonal antibodies, which you produce in the test tube. And if you're a manufacturer of monoclonal antibodies, or you're doing research into that, you know, you get a lot of, you can make money out of it, because you can patent it. You can't patent a horse. And, you know, that I found was extremely worrying. That's one of the reasons why I decided to go public, because I could see people who were there, who should have been agreeing with me, were keeping quiet, and I kind of smell a rat there. Maybe they're keeping quiet because they're getting, you know, grants from, they're doing research. You know the way it is. It's real world.
Thank you, okay.
Thank you very much.
Right. Pleasure. When are you, how old are you, and when are you taking up your journalism?
I'm year 11 at school.
Right.
I need to have work experience.